history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be told, and the rest of us are better off for hearing them. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I hear some of our youngest generation back there somewhere, but we're going to talk to a man known here in Carmel, California as HB, Howard Brunn. He doesn't want to tell us how old he is, but he flew in World War II. Let's go back before the war, Howard. You came here to Carmel as a very young boy. I'm sure it's changed a lot over your lifetime. What do you remember about this spot on the California map growing up?
Carmel was a wonderful place to grow up. It was a very small town. Today, those of you that are listening that have been to Carmel, you know it's beautiful. But we didn't have any tourists in those days. And it was just a sleepy little town. It was a very forward-looking town because there were a lot of artists and writers that had founded the city of Carmel. As I say, it was a great place to grow up.
You say artists and writers, and I've read some of what you've written. Did that kind of penchant for writing things down come early in life for you?
Possibly, because we had a very progressive school system. I started kind of writing things down at a very young age.
Do you remember, as a boy, having some dreams, some ambitions, some thoughts, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do?
Everyone wanted to drive a fire truck or fly an airplane.
So you went for the airplane?
Well, sure. When World War II started, I was still in high school, and there was a program at the Presidio of Monterey where you go over and you take a test and try and become an aviation cadet. Well, what they were doing was actually casting a very wide net, because for everyone that was going to get to be a pilot and fly airplanes, there had to be 20 or 30 people behind him that supported that system. So I passed it very easily, and I think almost everybody that took it passed it. And then eventually, when we got into pre-flight, then there were 6 weeks of winnowing out who was going to be flying airplanes and who was not going to be flying airplanes and was going to go to other schools. So that's the short story of how I got started.
Had you ever been in an airplane before?
I'd never been in a small plane that I can recall, no.
Well, and I'll back you up a little bit, because you say Carmel wasn't a tourist town then. It certainly is now. And it's not inexpensive to be a tourist here in Carmel. This is some of the most desired real estate in the country, and a lot of famous people are here on a daily basis. But back then, what did you guys do? I mean, how did you pass all the time around these parts? And were there really more deer than people here?
Well, in those days, we would, if we weren't going to school, we would take off in the morning on our bikes, and we would go down to the beach, and we'd go down to Carmel River. And sometimes we wouldn't come back until dinner time, and nobody worried about where we were or what we were doing. There was very good fishing in the Carmel River, and just what kids do, you know, kick the can down the road.
And you mentioned when the war started, but I'd be interested in hearing that. Because everybody seems to remember something about December 7th, 1941, and how the news came to you. So what do you remember?
Well, Carmel was really interesting. We were right here on the coast, and there were all kinds of stories, some of which you've read about, that the Japanese were in the fishing boats out of the Monterey Bay, that they were sending signals back home. There was a minor hysteria in Carmel and Monterey and the entire peninsula, and they moved in all kinds of troops. And right at the foot of Ocean Avenue in Carmel on the beach, they had machine guns set up. And then if you know Carmel, at the south of Point Lobos, they had a company of soldiers out there. And a lot of people that were wealthy and had money, they left Carmel, and the Pebble Beach area, which is the most exclusive area, you could buy a home for almost nothing. Huh. Because everyone headed for the Midwest. All of the rumors would circulate And there was one story that some people were attacking Carmel down on Carmel Beach. And the mayor of Carmel, his name was McCreary at the time, he went to the foot of Ocean Avenue and he stopped people from leaving Carmel. They actually were going to flee Carmel. And we had blackouts that were over the top. If you just show any little crack of light out of the window of your house, someone come banging on your door. Every block had a warden, and the warden's job was to see that there was no lights showing anywhere. And yet at the same time, people drove their cars around, and they had special little blue lights on the cars. It was really chaos.
And for a teenager, was that scary? I mean, did you fear a Japanese invasion?
Well, I was in high school, and we had very good teachers, and all of them actually very soon got drafted or had been drafted. But they started us, one of them named Donald Craig, who later became a commander and received the second highest award, the Navy Cross. He had us each start making a diary of what was going on. And that was a smart thing because it caused us to think a little bit and write it all down. Do I have any of that? No, I certainly don't.
But you do have your handwritten accounts of the missions that you flew in World War II, all 70 of them. We're going to hear about that. You also mentioned Mayor McCreary. At that time, you didn't know that you would succeed him in that office someday with a few mayors in between. But so you're a teenager. All this chaos is happening around you. And I guess I have to ask also, did you have any Japanese-American friends here in Carmel?
I did. And I'm very involved to this day with the Japanese, the Nisi and the Isi. And yes, I did. The Miyamoto family was an interesting family. And there were four brothers, and they were all star athletes. And the youngest one was Gordy Miyamoto. And he was one class behind me in Carmel High School. We had an interesting thing that we did a few years ago, maybe 15 years ago. A friend of mine and I got together. Gordy Miyamoto never graduated from Carmel High School because as soon as the war started, they swept him up and took him off, and he ended up in what I call a concentration camp. We called them relocation camps, but that's hardly what they were. They were concentration camps, completely against the Constitution of the United States. But be that as it may, Gordy never graduated, so on his birthday, we were going to give him a big party, which we did at a house out in Carmel Meadows. And then we got the present principal of Carmel High School, was that happened to be a lady. And in the middle of this big party, we stopped everything, and we gave Gordy his graduation diploma from Carmel High School all those years later. But he was an activist himself, Gordy Miyamoto, and there's a lot going on even to this day. There's a movie coming out that I'm in about the history of the people in the Carmel area that welcomed home the Japanese Americans and help them get started again. Now, very close to here, Salinas, quite the contrary, they were not welcomed home. And some of them did get started and became very successful. But there's a big contrast the way people in the Carmel area treated the returning Japanese and the way some other areas didn't want them back there. And they'd already taken their land away from them and they'd sold it and they had nothing.
And you mentioned that, and I feel obligated to mention that Monterey is one of only 10 cities in the country that's going to get a traveling exhibit put on for the Go for Broke National Education Center that tells the story of the Japanese internment through the eyes of local families right here on the peninsula that endured some of those hardships. And as you describe it, I get the sense that you see clearly the injustice of it now. But did you recognize that then? Was it jarring to see these Japanese-American friends gone all of a sudden?
We didn't understand what was happening. I mean, everybody was going to go to war and do what they were told to do. And we assumed the government knew what they were doing as kids, you know. But it didn't seem to bother. No, we didn't focus on what was happening.
And just to wrap that little topic up, you said that you're going to be part of this this movie, I guess a documentary that tells this story. So were you involved after the war in helping some Japanese-American families, or you just observed it?
I wasn't involved, because right after the war, for about 8 or 10 years, I was not living here. I was living in the Los Angeles area, and I wasn't involved.
Because you were trying to be a Hollywood star, or what?
Well, something like that, I guess. I was studying dramatic arts.
Well, I heard you were an actor, but I know everything today is not an act. It's the gospel truth. So you told us that you enlisted in the Army Air Corps at 17. You're going through that cadet training. Did you have an idea of what kind of planes you wanted to fly?
I guess most kids thought they wanted to fly fighters. And I ended up going to a school where in our advanced training, half of our class went into twin-engine P-38s and the other half went into twin-engine bombers, and I drew the bomber half.
You ever wonder about that, what it would have been like to fly P-38s?
Oh, I did fly it. Yeah, I flew it a little bit in training. It's a wonderful airplane, but it was not successful.
Was that before they reversed the prop?
Interesting. You should know that. Yeah, it was called a P-322 that we were training in. For some strange reason, the engines were made in England. They didn't reverse the props, but it was easy enough to fly.
A lot of guys died because of that before they figured out that they needed to make that change.
Well, we lost a lot of young guys in training, and this is something that was never publicized during the war. It was considered aid and comfort to the enemy. We lost 15,000 or so kids in World War II in the training command, and every class I was in, we lost some, and in the P-38 class, we lost four in one night. Because they didn't know how to, we were up flying at night and a storm moved in and we hadn't had any instrument training. And something happened that never happens around the Phoenix area. Storms never move in, and one moved in.
You were flying that night too?
I certainly was not, no.
Otherwise you might not be here.
I certainly might not be here, yeah.
But I'm sure you have a lot of other moments like that where you might not have been here. During that training time, was there something that you saw or experienced as the biggest challenge or the thing that made you the most nervous or intimidated?
No, you know, landing the airplane was always the skill that you were kind of measured by. Did you make a good landing or a bad landing? No, we worked hard on all areas, and I was comfortable. We were getting good training, and that I was a good pilot, or going to be.
So were you eager to get overseas and be a part of this?
I don't know if eager is the right word. I certainly knew that I wanted to put to use the training I'd had. I had no idea where I would go in the world because the B-25 was flying in every theater. I thought I would go to the Pacific. When we finally went overseas as a crew, that's an interesting story in itself. We had a brand new airplane that we had picked up, and we were scheduled to go over with a large group of planes, about 35 or 40. They had not told us exactly where we were going, but finally they had to because they were going to send us over as a group with doctors and nurses. And at the last minute, it turned out the airplane we'd been given had a bad engine and we could not go with them. We followed where they went and we had some training because they'd shown movies of various fields that we'd be landing at, etc. We didn't leave until 30 days later. We were in West Palm Beach, Florida, and we would change an engine overnight in Corsica. It took them 30 days to change a new engine with what we called the ground pounders doing the job. So we were able to get on. It was very secret where we were. Our only address was an APO number. Nobody knew, you know, we couldn't tell anybody where we were. But finally we took off all by ourselves, and we went down the coast of South America, and we went to Belém, Brazil, Natal, Brazil, across to a little piece of land in the middle of the South Atlantic called the Ascension Island, over into Africa, up the coast of Africa into Liberia, and then across to Tunisia. We were following where the war had been, and then when we got to Tunisia, the war had just ended there. There were still smoking ships in the harbor, and then we left the airplane there, and they took us up to Corsica where we joined our combat group. But that trip took us 30 days because we had nobody telling us what to do or where to go. And we could stop here and there, which we did. And it was a fantastic adventure in itself.
But nowhere along the way you hit bad weather or navigational challenges? I've heard, you know, just getting to Ascension Island was quite a bear sometimes.
Well, we did. There was one at Belém, Brazil, which was the last stop before Natal, where we took off for Ascension. At Belém, there was a small strip just right out of the middle of the jungle that the engineers had put in there, and we landed there. and there was a major there who, it was in the early afternoon, but he also had been drinking already. And this guy was old, and you could kind of tell he was probably in his 30s, that they'd put him out there to run this place. So the next morning when we got up to take off, I went to look at the weather. And then I saw this major. I said, you know, I've had instrument training, but there's a big front right across the middle of where we're going to be going. And I'd rather wait a couple of days because my instrument training, I've never actually had a lot of actual instruments. In fact, I've probably had none. So he says, son, you know, you'll be here the rest of the war. He says, that front is always there. And sure enough, I found out talking to other pilots since there is always a front right across the coast of South America in that area. So we had to take off as it was. And we tried to all the things we were told to try. We couldn't get under it and we couldn't get over it. So we flew parallel and took a turn directly into it, hoping that we would go through. We could not see where the clouds were that separated the front, and sure enough, we flew right into, practically into, near the eye of the storm was, and then we fought that thing for about 10 or 15 minutes, my co-pilot, myself, it was just physical. We were being battered around. Obviously, we got through, but we had some real questions about that, and if we had gone down in the jungle, they would not even send out an airplane to look for you because your airplane would just disappear. The jungle was a couple of hundred feet high and there wouldn't even be a swath to show that you went into it. So that was an adventure in itself.
I don't know if adventure is the word I would use. I mean, it sounds kind of terrifying. That 15 minutes fighting that storm probably felt like an eternity.
Well, it did, and it was terrifying, but, you know, and we were sure perspiring. But we just fought those controls, you know, the altimeter and the airspeed were kind of moving around faster than we could follow them with our eyes.
And that was before he ever entered combat. Howard Brunn is our guest today. Find photos of Howard then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll also find a link to his unique book, Flaps Up, featuring poetry, prose, and pictures. 70 missions as a B-25 pilot during World War II, and we'll explore those memories when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Howard Brunn of Carmel, California, a recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross as a pilot completing 70 missions with the 428th Squadron of the 310th Bomb Group, part of the famed 57th Bomb Wing. Let's hear a little bit about the kind of plane he was flying, the B-25 Mitchell Bomber.
Well, the B-25 is a wonderful aircraft to fly. It's one of the best things that came out of World War II. It was kind of like the Jeep or the Grand Rifle, and there were 15,000 or so of them built, and it was a very forgiving airplane. It would take tremendous punishment, and still fly. And the engines were the R2300, I think it is, right? The huge radial engine is the greatest engine that came out of World War II and was used in many other airplanes. It was used as single engine in fighters. So we loved the airplane.
And how many men on your crew, how many lives were you responsible for when you're at the controls?
There were six of us. There are three enlisted and three officers, pilot, co-pilot, and bombardier or bombardier navigator. Those were the officers. And then We had three enlisted. We had an engineer gunner. We had a radio man gunner who was in the aft part of the airplane, and he had two 50 caliber machine guns, one on each side. And then we had the famous tail gunner who was facing backwards, and he also had a power turret with two 50 calibers.
And you mentioned Corsica, which is where you'd end up flying your missions. You mentioned that you had a crew that you went overseas with. How long were you able to keep that same crew, that same group of guys together?
It was very interesting. We really were close by then, and we were able, by hook or by crook, we were able to fly out of our 70 missions. We were able to stay together and fly about 55 of those missions together. And they all knew that we wanted to stay together, and we just had a little chain of command. When they were assigning the missions, they would keep us together if they could. And then, of course, we would have to split up when we'd go on rest leaves and this and that. But we flew most of them together, and we were able to stay together and have reunions after the war. But it turned out gradually that I was the only person from the West Coast. These other guys were closer together in the South Carolina area. There were two or three of them lived there. Some of them became extremely successful. So we gradually drifted apart. But the last one of those crew members died 8 years ago. That was my bombardier navigator, George Spiro.
And you may not know the answer to this. How many different airplanes do you think you flew in that 70 mission span?
That's an interesting story in itself. I had my own airplane. I had Nicky's Bomber number 2, but the name of the airplane, it had a lot of missions on it when I acquired it. And Al Sawyer was my crew chief from Texas, and he had been with the 57th Bomb Wing since it started out in the States, and he'd been over there a long time. And he was an amazing mechanic, and he had five or six guys working with him, keeping that airplane going. He would fly with me now and then, and we'd always have to test it when it needed to get back in the air. And he could fly beautifully. And I always wanted him to teach him to land, but he would never let me teach him to land for some strange reason. He didn't want to land the airplane. And he was not a person I could get really close to. And I finally figured that out, because he'd been over there a long, long time, and he'd lost two or three airplanes and two or three different groups of guys. He just somehow subliminally did not want to be really close buddies with me. But we'd fly together, and once we flew over to Italy together and spent a couple of days in Italy, he took off and I took off, but he flew over as my co-pilot. Anyhow, he was a great guy, and I didn't stay in touch with him after the war. I tried to find him, but never could.
And what you're describing, that was his defense mechanism. He'd lost so many guys, he's not going to get close enough to feel the hurt of losing someone like you. And
that's accurate, yeah.
And you flew most of your missions in that specific aircraft?
Yeah, I did. The name of it, we had our own name for it, but the name of it was Cielito Lindo. And Al Sawyer received a medal from the 12th Air Force. It's a non-combat medal called a soldier's medal, because he had 112 missions on that airplane on the original engines, which was almost unheard of. And it had its disadvantages. Those original engines, as meticulous as they were old.
Actually, I think I've seen a picture of the Cielito Lindo in your book. But what was the nose art on that?
There was no real nose art, and the whole front of it was covered with mission bombs. They ran out of places to put the bombs for the missions.
Well, and you mentioned the soldier's medal for Al Sawyer, your crew chief, and that's the highest non-combat decoration anyone can earn. It's very prestigious and very rare, almost in many ways more rare than a lot of the medals you hear
more
about.
My bombardier also got one of those medals. We had fragmentation bombs, which were some of the bombs that we would carry. We had various bomb loads, a 1,000-pound bomb, 250-pound bomb, 500-pound bomb. But the frag bombs were anti-personnel bombs, and they were just like great big, they weighed 15, 20 pounds each, and they were in clusters. And those clusters would go down, and then they would split apart, and they would go on to the troops. And whenever we had those bombs, they were very unstable in the bomb bay. And every now and then, and this happened to us, we could not drop them, and we could not bring them back, because we could not land with those in the bomb bay. So guess what? Somebody had to go down in that bomb bay and what we call knock them out of there.
You can't land with it, because if you do and it detonates there, That's going to kill some people.
Yeah, you're going to blow up. So George Spiro volunteered. He would not necessarily have been the one to go down there because Jack Carter, my tail gunner, was also the armorer, was part of his job. And he would normally be the one to do that. George said, I'll do it. And so he clambered back there and kind of hung by his teeth and knocked those bombs out of there. And it took him a little while to do it, and they handed him a big hammer from up above. Incidentally, he could not wear a parachute because there was just a small hole, and our parachutes were chest chutes, and he had to leave his parachute, and we all knew that. He was down there with no parachute. So that was kind of almost automatically he got a soldier's medal.
I bet that's probably some of the time where you flew that plane the steadiest in your whole career.
It was being flown very, very steady.
And I'm sorry, I know we're bouncing around, but you said the plane was named the Cielito Lindo, and that's what's painted on the nose, but you said you had your own name for it. Is that something you can say on the radio?
Oh, sure. Yeah. It was Nicky's Bomber number 2, and this was my little cousin, Nicky McMahon Wilson, and she is still around. In fact, I'm having dinner with she and her husband. She now has children and grandchildren of her own.
Well, not many people can go around and tell someone, hey, I had a World War II bomber named for me.
Yeah, she loves it. Yeah.
Well, and 70 missions is a heck of a lot of missions. Yes. And you hear from B-17 and B-24 pilots, and a lot of times they're saying, well, we flew 25 missions, or if it was later, 30 or 35. 70 missions. If you think about that now, just the thought of surviving 70 missions, does that seem a little daunting?
Well, it was very daunting, and we had no choice. There is a time that various people have told me, and I'm not sure I didn't experience myself, that in intense combat, you finally get to a certain point. Not that you think you might not make it, but that you know you're not going to make it. And if and when you reach that point, it gets easier for you.
You're just resigned to that fate?
Yeah, you kind of know you're not going to make it. And once you know that, you don't think about it anymore.
So when do you think you crossed that threshold?
I think I crossed that threshold about mission number 55 or 58 or long in there.
Well, I'm sure we don't have time to talk about all 70 missions, but I'm sure there are some that stand out for you that maybe were the most harrowing or the most successful, the most memorable. Can you tell us some of those stories?
Well, there's a mission that we call the ORA, O-R-A mission, that our particular squadron, we went in there one day and experienced a lot of anti-aircraft fire. And then we went back the second day on the ORA mission, and our particular squadron lost 3 airplanes. And it was also, incidentally, became a mission that was given, they singled out that mission for a presidential unit citation.
You guys must have done something of strategic importance then. What'd you do? What'd you knock out?
Oh, it was a bridge. You know, they're all important. There were about 28, maybe 32 bridges on the Brenner Pass, and they were all highly defended. And the ORA mission, I don't know it was any more important or less important, because they would rebuild the bridges almost overnight with slave labor.
Well, and you mentioned the Brenner Pass. Some people don't know where that is or why it mattered. So for someone who, you know, especially younger folks, explain to them why you guys were there, what you were doing, and why it was so important.
Well, the Brenner Pass, it's the only way to go from northern Italy into southern Germany. If you're on a tourist trip right now, there's a big 8-lane freeway going down to Brenner Pass, and it's a beautiful drive. But in those days, it was very small, and it was the only way for the enemy to get stuff down into northern Italy, and at the same time, it was the only way to get anything out of northern Italy. And so it was a really key to the whole war. And they put the heavy bombers in there to try and keep the Brenner Pass closed, and they could not. They had us in there, and we had heavy losses. They took us out, and they put the heavies back in, but the heavies could not hit the little bridges. That's why we had the nickname of the Bridge Busters. we were 100% accurate in flying at the altitude we would fly, anywhere from 8 to 12,000 feet. But the anti-aircraft was also 100% accurate at that same altitude. So they put us back in there, and they left us in there through the end of the war. They were increasing the anti-aircraft fire, and near the end of the war, they had automatic. They had very sophisticated, you know, the Germans are wonderful at putting things together. Very sophisticated anti-aircraft that would be firing almost automatically on, with a sort of form of radar. You got so you really couldn't dodge it.
What's that like when you know you're about to fly through a field of flak and there's nothing you can do about it?
You have what you call an IP point, an initial point. You can no longer take any evasive action. You have to go straight and level, and you have to hold the airplane. It becomes a bombing platform. It can last. You know, if you have a really good leader to your small little six airplanes, he can get you in and out of there very fast. If you have somebody that is more insistent on hitting the target, then takes a longer bomb run. So you knew right away how long your bomb run was going to be as soon as you started your initial point. And you also knew what it was going to be like because you knew who was flying the lead airplane.
What goes through your mind, or what do you physically do in those seconds right before? I mean, when you see those bursts in front of you and you know your plane's about to fly through stuff that could kill you, what are you doing?
Well, you're concentrating 100%, and your field of vision is pretty small because you're concentrating on flying very tight formation, because we would drop our bombs together all on one bomb site because we made that tight of a, we could hit small 28 and 30 foot bridges and take them out. So you're concentrating 100%. And in my field of vision, I would see a certain amount of flak, and I could sometimes hear flak and feel it, you know. But I wouldn't be, the guy that had the toughest time was the bombardier in the front. He just had to sit there in that glass cage, and he'd see everything. And that was a very difficult position to be.
You said sometimes you could hear it and feel it. What does that sound like? What does it feel like?
Well, you can just, when a piece of flak, sometime maybe a huge piece, hits your airplane, you know, you can feel it. And you can smell it sometimes.
But none of your crew was ever wounded by it?
We could have had two or three Purple Hearts, because wounded, to get a Purple Heart, you have to draw blood. And that would sometimes happen, particularly with my bombardier, but we didn't want to report that because then you'd have to go to a hospital and it was a long distance away. And so we didn't receive, we might have gotten one Purple Heart, I don't remember for sure. My tail gunner, Jack Carter, sustained a very strong hit one day. All I could hear was, I'm hit. And I told Henderson, the radio man, to go back and see what's going on with Jack. And he called back and he says, he's going to be okay. A huge piece of flak had come through right near his left part of his body, and there was a whole bunch of 50 caliber machine gun stacked up in that area, and it went right through those and hit him in his back and left a big black and blue mark, but saved his life because it broke up when it hit. All those 50 calibers didn't go off. They just broke up that piece of flak. So it really sounded like he'd had a major problem, and he dodged it completely.
And what about you? What's the closest you think flak came to getting a piece of you?
Well, I don't know. The windshield was never blown up.
Did you ever count the holes in your plane on landing?
Yeah, we used to count the holes sometimes, yeah.
What was the record?
Oh, in the high 80s.
And you say all this like it's no big deal, but this is your life at stake, and you're in your early 20s.
I don't know why we count. We didn't count the holes. The guys that were patching them counted them. And, you know, they weren't interested in having the airplane necessarily look nice. So, you know, they'd patch them, and then there would be new patches all over the old airplane.
I was going to say, if you flew 55 in that same plane, it must have been nothing but patches by the end.
No, it kept it in good shape.
Well, and you've kept in good shape. Howard Brunn, or simply HB, as so many know him, in Carmel, California. It's break time again, but we'll hear more of his memories from 70 World War II missions as a B-25 pilot when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Howard Brunn, a longtime resident of Carmel, California, where you can pick up his book, Flaps Up, at the Carmel Bay Company, a business he started once upon a time. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can read his Distinguished Flying Cross citation. But why don't I read that for you right now as well? And I guess I should note that he was born Howard Brunn Levinson, later dropped the last name 15 years after World War II. So this citation, signed by Brigadier General Charles Myers, says, Howard B. Levinson, 1st Lieutenant, 428th Bomb Squadron, 310th Bomb Group, for extraordinary achievement while participating in aerial flight as a pilot of a B-25 type aircraft. On 11 November 1944, Lieutenant Levinson flew in an attack upon a heavily defended railroad bridge at Cagliano, Italy. Upon the commencement of the bomb run, shell fragments from intense anti-aircraft fire damaged Lieutenant Levinson's airplane and 9 other bombers. Determinedly maintaining his position in formation for the run over the objective in the face of this strong resistance, Lieutenant Levinson enabled his bombardier to release his bombs with devastating effect upon this vital bridge. On more than 60 combat missions, his outstanding proficiency and devotion to duty have reflected great credit upon the armed forces of the United States. Well, thanks for letting me read that, Howard. That reflected the heavy flak that you talked about earlier. But what about enemy fighters? Did you ever encounter any of them?
We had almost no, very little. When we were maybe going to have fighters, we would have escort. We had wonderful escort, and we had the Red Tails that everyone's heard so much about escorting us. And then we had P-47s escorting us. They would fly alongside of us, and they had big radial engines, and they were told, don't ever point those engines at us, because they had that had happened once, and it was mistaken, and we shot down a P-47.
Because you thought it was an ME-109 or something?
Yeah. Exactly. That's what it looked like.
But the Red Tails were usually in P-51s.
They didn't get the P-51s in Italy very soon. They were still in P-47s. And near the end of the war, all the P-51s went to Germany. Went to the 8th Air Force. And we finally got some near the end of the war.
And some people, when you say Red Tails, some people know what you're talking about. There was even a movie in the last few years by that title. But these are the Tuskegee Airmen, the African-American pilots. How did you guys feel about them? Did you know who they were and what they were doing?
Well, the military was a segregated military. We didn't even know that they were training at one point the same airfield that we were in. And no, we had no contact with them. We had great admiration for them because we knew and we'd heard they were the best. And they were the best. They were the most educated black guys that they could find because they wanted them to really be the best. And they were a very special group of men. And what they did after the war, the stories are legion of how successful many of them became. We never had any contact with them on the ground. It was a segregated military.
Have you ever met any of them in the years since the war?
Just shaking hands with one guy who became a very well-known surgeon. A friend of mine is a close friend of his, but I have no friends in that group of people. I wish I did.
I know you were out there carrying out your orders. and you were risking your life every day. But their duty as escort was to protect you guys and save your lives, right?
Yeah, and they were great. And they would put on a little show for us sometimes, because when they would leave us, very often they would go down and strafe targets of opportunity into Brenner Pass. And but before they'd go, they'd fly parallel to us, and then they would go up very high and do a beautiful split S right down to the ground.
Like your own private air show.
Yeah, that's what it was. They'd put a little air show on for us.
So you didn't see a lot of fighters thanks to those guys. You faced a lot of flak. What about other hazards that maybe people wouldn't expect when you're flying that many missions?
Well, you always have weather. You're always battling the weather. The information about weather, you know, we would send weather ships up because there was no point in putting together a whole mission, take 4 or 5 hours to get it up in the air. So weather was a constant friend or enemy.
Do you have one specific example that maybe seemed the worst to you that left you feeling like you weren't sure you were going to land that thing?
Well, there was one time where, by mistake, the lead ship coming back from Yugoslavia over Italy, it had been a very long mission, and for some strange reason took an entire formation of airplanes, maybe as many as 70, and flew us right into blind flying conditions. We were coming down a little bit. We were down about 4,000 or 5,000 feet, and we were instructed to do was to turn out a certain number of ship lengths and then go straight up. And that's what I did. I turned out, and then I went straight up. But I went up and up, and pretty soon we're getting up to where it's going to be 8,000 or 9,000 or 10,000 feet. I'm noticing that it's completely white all over me. There's kind of snow coming through the windshield. And I didn't know what was going to happen. Because if we didn't break out, we had no way to get home. We had no way to know where we were. We knew generally the area of the Mediterranean and where Corsica was, but we had no way to possibly get there. But finally, we broke through about 9,000 or 10,000 feet. A lot of the guys in that situation landed there. They were getting a little low on fuel, and they landed in all over Italy. And then some of us, about a third of us, decided that we had enough fuel and went back to Corsica, and we were in that group, and we went back.
I'm just trying to imagine what that feels like. And I've driven in a blizzard before, you know, where you can't get off the road because you can't see the side of the road, and you're going slow, and you're pressed up against the windshield.
That was exactly the situation. You're glued to the instruments, of course.
But you're climbing further away from terra firma. So you're in a lot more danger than me driving 15 miles an hour in a blizzard. So I'm just wondering what goes through your head. Are you closing your eyes, gritting your teeth? You saying a prayer? What are you doing?
You're just flying the airplane as carefully as you can. And not one airplane was lost to weather in that situation.
Now, the guys flying the heavies, if they lost an engine, they still have got three more to rely on. If you lose an engine...
It never happened, but the single engine performance of a B-25 was quite good. You could lose an engine, and you could maintain altitude of 3,500 to 6,000 feet. So you could even climb a little bit, depending where you were.
And since you flew your missions, you said, generally 8,000 to 12,000 feet. So I'm sure your cabin conditions were the same as when you flew to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Bay Area, right? Just about as comfortable and cozy?
Well, the pilots were great, and they took me and my friend Joe up into the cockpit of the airplane.
Well, I want to hear more about that experience, but what were the cockpit conditions in a B-25? Did it get a little chilly up there?
I see those airplanes, you know, and I marvel at how little space there was for myself and the co-pilot. It's very little space.
What about the temperature? Do you have a heated suit? Did you need one?
We could have used one on occasion, but no, we didn't. We had very warm clothing and great big boots to put over our shoes, and we were comfortable, but there was no heat.
And I don't want to miss anything that's important to you. Are there other missions that you look back on and you're either particularly proud of or just particularly thankful you survived them?
Oh, I suppose so, but nothing specifically comes to mind. There were a lot of wonderful times flying in the States. Very nice experiences.
Well, and I've heard just in your description the fondness you had for your crew that you had for the bulk of your missions and your admiration for your crew chief who kept that plane flying for all those missions. What gives you pride today in being part of this generation, part of the millions and millions of Americans who went out there and preserved freedom and defeated tyranny?
What gives me pride today is an entirely different subject. The reason we were able to do what we were able to do was the government understands that you can't be a certain age and do these things. You have to be young, and you best not be married. And hopefully you don't have any children, because they're sending you out there to do something that no human being does normally. We are not taught to kill each other. We're going out there and we're going to try and kill somebody else. This is a very foreign thing. You have to be very young. And that's why when you see in the Congress of the United States, you don't see the kids of those people going off to war very often. Now, the Kennedys were an exception, and the Bushes also were an exception. But if more of the kids were going to go, they wouldn't be so quick to send us. You know, we haven't won any of the last 16 wars. Why are we having the wars? Eisenhower, I think it was in his final speech, was that Eisenhower said, beware the military-industrial complex. He finally had figured it out. It was a little bit too late, but he understood why our government is what it is. And having been to Washington, D.C., and seen the various monuments to war, and that's what they are, and they work beautifully. You know, they have no unions, everybody gets paid. It was a great experience.
Well, on that topic, and I do want to hear what it meant to you to go to Washington, D.C., to see that World War II memorial that honors 400,000 Americans who died in World War II. And what it makes me wonder is if you lost close friends of yours, if you knew people who died in the war.
Well, certainly, yeah.
Other pilots you trained with?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, while we were getting shot down.
You probably saw other B-25s get shot down pretty close to you.
Well, sure. That when we came back from the Aura mission, I had two roommates, and when we came back, I was alone in the room.
How did you process that as a 20-something-year-old kid?
It wasn't cool. It was not nice. It was an interesting side to that. We talked a little bit about missing in action. That was a thing that various families would get a letter from our commanding officer, and if he didn't have cross checks, the intelligence people would, when someone shoots were seen, if someone was going down or whatever, as soon as you'd land, the intelligence people would take the various people that had seen this and get their various first-hand reports. And those first-hand reports would never be maybe exactly the same. We knew somebody had been killed. But if the commanding officer, Colonel Epperson, who was our commanding officer, who'd been on the Doolittle raid, he had to send that letter home. He had to say missing in action unless he had a cross-check from three different people. And often we knew that that missing in action letter had gone out, but that that person was not missing in action. That person was dead. You know, there was one incident where a parachute was on fire, and one person had seen that, but they couldn't cross-check it. So sometimes when we knew that, we would contact those families. I was never part of a group that did that, but quite a few families got contacted by some of our guys, and they met with them after they got back to the States. And I think that was a great thing for them to do.
Yeah, and they could have gotten in trouble for doing that, but they cared more about the person than the protocol.
Yeah, exactly. That's well said. Yeah.
Well, speaking of well said, you have something that you wrote out in 1944. This is part of your book as well, and I'm going to read a portion for our listeners. We're having this conversation in the lobby of the historic Pine Inn here in Carmel, and this account was published in the Carmel Pine Cone 74 years ago. It is here on the bomb run, more than anywhere else, that the bomber and her crew are put to the test. Men and machine meet the test. They sweat. They pray. Their insides feel all wrong. Their nerves and senses reach an unknown peak. Sometimes they shatter. Anyone who has ever been up there knows the feeling of life. Life is a sweet, precious thing. On the bomb run, life is sometimes cheap. and it continues in descriptive fashion every element of a B-25 mission in World War II, right down to when that anti-aircraft fire ensues. It says, getting flak now. There's a thud and a lurch on the ship as a piece of hot metal rips through her delicate hide. Flak at 6 o'clock. They're tracking us, coming up on the tail. Let's get out of here. Your ears ring from the shouted information over the interphone. You're on the bomb run. Hold her steady. How easy it would be to break away and clear out of this. How impossible. Bomb bay doors open. The vibration of the heavy doors is like a living thing. The co-pilot is low in his seat, a pair of wide eyes just visible under his flak helmet and glued to the instruments. He doesn't look out. From the corner of your eye, you see nasty, impersonal flak clouds bursting close. Yes, you can even smell and hear the stuff. Now steady. If you ever flew, do it now. Steady. Bombs away. Doors closed. And we don't have time to read the entire thing, but again, you can read this online at hometownheroesradio.com. And here's the conclusion. Your hands are sticky in the gloves. Your ears hurt from the pressure of the headset. Your whole body is crying out to relax and stretch. You move your head in an arc to feel tensed and tired neck muscles hurt. You give the ship to the co-pilot for a while and are on the way back to base. The crew is not wounded. The ship will make it home. You may have to sweat out gas and weather. The job isn't finished. The bomb run is. So, Howard, when you hear that, or when you just read it again, what comes to mind?
It's accurate.
Do you start to feel it again when you read that?
No. Oh, I'll have to tell you a little story why I can sit here with you and talk to you about these things. Some years ago, I went through a post-traumatic stress syndrome situation over a period of years, and I was treated by the VA for that. And it's a diagnosis is what it is. I finally didn't have any problems like that anymore a few years ago. And I'm able now to sit here and talk to you because I can take a complete historical perspective on all of it. And it doesn't bother me in the least.
It doesn't trigger your emotions.
It does not. Or I couldn't do it.
Well, what about the honor flight? Did that stir some emotions to go to that spot and contemplate what it represented?
Not very much. But when we went to the Air Force one, it was interesting. They had a list of the various missions that the Air Force had flown in the Mediterranean area. I was able to go over there and see the list. You get a little star to wear on your ribbon if you were in a battle. I was in four or five battles, and here they were all listed on this marble thing. And it was really fascinating to see that.
And that's one of the best spots in D.C. The views from that Air Force Memorial are spectacular. What did you get out of that whole experience, to go back there with other veterans, to experience those things, and then come back here to the Bay Area?
It was a wonderful trip. It was completely well organized.
Well, and I know, like you just said, you can detach yourself from it and it doesn't trigger the emotions. And I know you're not looking to brag about what you did. You're not looking for attention for it. I clearly hear how you feel about war. And I know you probably wouldn't brag about this either, but something that I think a lot of people admire about you, and if they've read your book Flaps Up and seen some of your poetry, they certainly see this. But you didn't go on the honor flight until last year because you refused to go while your wife was still alive. You didn't want to leave her side.
Well, yeah, that was my life for a number of years.
And you've written some poems that are in that book about her battle with Alzheimer's and walking through that with her. What do you want people to understand when they read those?
I don't have any thoughts for, you know, it's a very sad part of my life.
Well, and I'm sorry for posing that question to you without warning. How about I do this? There are several very poignant poems in your book about that long journey with your late wife, Courtney. This one is opposite a beautiful photo of her standing in the doorway. You titled it Shadow Memories. Her shadow is with me always, a distant memory of a distant love, expressing itself still. In a faint smile, turn of her head, still strong grip on my arm, radiating inner beauty and strength. While sliding quickly into year 5 and the uncertain future for us both. Oh, and that's just a sampling, some real powerful poems in this book. And I know a lot of people listening have walked down that same road, or maybe they're doing so right now, maybe with a spouse, a parent. But the way you capture it is very powerful, very moving. And again, Howard's book is called Flaps Up, Poetry, Prose, and Pictures. I have a link to it at hometownheroesradio.com. Or the next time you're on the Monterey Peninsula, stop into the Carmel Bay Company and pick up a copy there. And I know you don't have time to go through everything that you've done in this city as a member of the city council, eventually the mayor, a business owner, an activist for causes you care about. What would you say that you're most proud of as far as your contributions to your hometown?
Small town politics are where it all starts. It's a lot of fun to do. It's a lot of fun to be interested in small town politics. The village of Carmel no longer exists. About 70% of the homes in Carmel, if the lot were vacant, it would be cost over $1 million, are owned by people that don't live in them. There are no children living in Carmel.
Well, if there's anything else you want to add, certainly feel free. But I want to thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us your unique story. You've had quite a life and it doesn't sound like you're done yet.
No, I'm making plans to be over 100.
Is there something on your list? Is there something that you haven't done yet that you want to see happen in your lifetime?
Not specifically, no, but I have certain goals. I'd like to get out there that if you're interested in this country, become interested in the Veterans for Peace organization.
Well, one thing I can tell about you, Howard, in the short time that we've spent together is that you are so sincere and you devote your entire being to the things that you care about. Thanks again, Howard Brunn. He doesn't want me to tell you how old he is. You can take your best guess if you run into him in Carmel, California, where he's lived almost his entire life. Big thanks to Joe Fry, who was Howard's volunteer guardian with Honor Flight Bay Area. He introduced me to Howard so I could introduce him to you. There are a whole lot of photos for you to explore at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And thanks so much for listening to the program today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.